May it please the court, my name is David Karp. I represent the appellant, Lee Wilson. Lee Wilson was convicted after a jury verdict of being a felon in possession of ammunition. Our position is that he was not properly charged and convicted of this. This is a case of first impression in this circuit, although other circuits have taken up the issue. From our point of view, it turns on the distinction between ammunition and firearms and the distinction of the policy reasons for which Congress forbids such possession by ex-felons. Now, Mr. Wilson received a discharge notice from the state of Wisconsin when he completed his prior Wisconsin felony sentences. And in that discharge, he was told that civil rights were being restored. It does exclude a couple of civil rights. And I realize that I have an uphill battle here with regard to that particular issue, but the plain meaning of the statute that this all turns on, which is United States Code Title 18, Section 921A20, does say that it becomes an issue when civil rights are restored. It doesn't say all civil rights, but when civil rights are restored.
Unless it says you can't possess firearms, which this certificate said.
Judge Easterbrook, that's the perfect point to bring up, because that would kick in the mouse-trapping clause, unless it's the mouse-trapping clause. And the mouse-trapping clause is silent as to ammunition. The mouse-trapping clause is silent as to ammunition. Wisconsin state statutes don't place Mr. Wilson on notice that he may not possess ammunition.
Counselor, the problem is that the federal statute says you remain a convicted felon if the certificate of discharge says that you can't possess firearms. You're then a convicted felon for purposes of federal law, and it's federal law, not state law, that defines whether a convicted felon can possess ammunition. That's the logical sequence, right? And what you're asking us to do is to look to state law in some way for the ammunition possession question, but I don't see how we get to state law.
The state law would define the discharge. Federal policy would define how we interpret the unless clause, the mouse-trapping clause. The statute
What is the interpretive problem, right? The statute says any conviction that has been expunged, etc., shall not be considered a conviction for purposes of this chapter unless such pardon, expungement, or restoration of civil rights expressly provides that the person may not ship, transport, possess, or receive firearms. Well, the unless clause is satisfied, and therefore the conviction continues to count as a conviction for federal purposes. And then you look elsewhere in the federal code to find out what a convicted felon may or may not do. Am I missing anything in the statutory language?
The unless clause doesn't mention ammunition.
But look, you just parse the clause. It says, if a conviction has been expunged, it doesn't count unless the certificate says the person can't possess firearms. Well, your client has a certificate. It says the person can't possess firearms. Therefore, this whole last sentence falls out. And what you have is somebody who has a conviction for purposes of federal law.
He has a conviction, Your Honor.
As I say, what am I missing?
He has a conviction for purposes of firearms. He never received notice that he couldn't possess ammunition.
There's nothing about receiving such notice in federal law. You don't need to receive notice about the rules of federal law.
How is a person supposed to know what
you might
may
look in the U.S. Code and find out whether a convicted felon can possess ammunition? But we usually say that the terms of the U.S. Code are themselves adequate notice. You don't have to tell people everything that's in Title 18. That's the problem here.
The Miller court found, however, that ammunition was, in fact, not covered. And, in fact, the policy reasons for prohibiting firearms are different than those possessing ammunition.
Let me indicate to you, for example, just possessing a silencer is a violation of the firearms. Now, how are we distinguishing a silencer, which is prohibited as a firearm, from ammunition? I mean, why is it any different? And who would suspect, for example, that possessing a silencer only would be a violation of the U.S. Code?
I agree. However, that would be defined as a firearm under 921, whereas ammunition is not a weapon. Ammunition is, in fact, it can be just...
Well, silencer is not a weapon either. I mean, it's, you add it to the weapon.
It's integral to it. The receiver of the firearm is also considered a firearm. However, ammunition doesn't fall under that ambit. If you even have a bullet, arguably, if you're shot and you're carrying a bullet in your leg, you're possessing
I don't think you're getting either Judge Kaney's concern or mine. If there's nothing the state is going to send to anybody is going to inform the convicted felon what all the requirements of federal law are. Nothing is going to say you can't possess ammunition, silencers, auto sears, you know, all the long sawed-off shotguns, all the list of things that are specifically covered in federal law. In order to find out what federal law requires, you don't look to documents the state sends you. You look to the federal code.
But ostensibly based on the discharge and based on Wisconsin statutes, Mr. Wilson could reasonably have thought that he, in fact, was allowed to possess ammunition. Again, ammunition is not his...
No, I guess we're just talking past one another.
Okay.
The question is not what Wisconsin allows him to possess. The question for purposes of federal law is he a, quote, convicted felon, close quote? That's the thing we get out of the terms of the discharge certificate. And the answer, I thought you had agreed with me earlier, is yes. Because the certificate says you can't possess firearms, he remains a convicted felon. And then what a convicted felon can do depends entirely on what's in the federal code.
I would submit he's a convicted felon for purposes of firearms, but it's not, there's less than total...
Is there any support in the language? What would you rely on for the proposition that you could be a convicted felon for purposes of a pistol, but not for purposes of a silencer, say?
Well, now that would be different because those are both firearms, and those have the same policy. You can't basically
or a grenade, or a bazooka, or any of the other things that's covered in these federal statutes.
Well, we're talking about a state, Wisconsin, where the right to hunt is constitutionally protected.
I'm asking you to talk about federal law.
Yes.
This is a question of federal law in the end. What language of the federal statute would you rely on for the proposition that you can be a convicted felon for the purposes of some objects, like pistol, but not a convicted felon for the purposes of other objects, whether they be silencers or bullets? What would be your principal statutory hook for that argument?
That would be the language preceding the unless clause in 921A20, where you'd look at, okay, the conviction shall not be considered a conviction for these purposes where civil rights have been restored. And then you go to the you interpret.
You're either going to be a convicted felon or not, depending on what's in the discharge certificate. But the argument you're making is that you can be a convicted felon for purposes of one object and not for purposes of another. That, of course, is not what that sentence says. That sentence says you're either a convicted felon or you're not. That's why I'm asking, is there something else in the federal code?
Well, just because a government would take away a person's right to drive doesn't mean the person cannot buy gasoline. You can't hold... I've never heard of someone holding up a liquor store by holding up a box of bullets and saying, playing, giving you money. There's less danger implied in mere possession of bullets. Can relatives leave ammunition at someone's house?
I can understand it, but now you're just disagreeing with the federal statute. You're saying there's no danger in convicted felons possessing ammunition independent of means to fire the ammunition, and therefore they should be allowed to, but that's not what the federal statute says. My question is about language in the federal statute. It's not about arguments of good policy.
But, Your Honor, I think it's clear that policy concerns drive the interpretation of the mouse-trapping statute, of the mouse-trapping clause, that you have to look at the policy concerns in order to interpret it, and that's how courts do it. Now, the Ninth Circuit supports my position in the Miller case. The U.S. Supreme Court has not reached this point. Interestingly enough, I hope I'm saying this name right, Caron, C-A-R-O-N, the U.S. Supreme Court chose not to reach the ammunition question, although there's ammunition in that case as well. There in Caron, the U.S. Supreme Court found that that because Massachusetts forbade, under limited circumstances, one type of firearm, that would prohibit all types of firearms. However, they didn't say anything about the ammunition Caron possessed. So it is an open question. Although Mr. Wilson perhaps has not had the slate wiped totally clean from the point of view of his not being allowed to hold office or possess firearms, that under the plain language of 921A20, civil rights have been restored. So then you're going to go to the policy concerns that made Congress, in response to the Dickerson case, write 921A20, and why they put firearms and why they did not put ammunition. Mr. Wilson's rights were not discharged conditionally. They were the discharge paper he got says absolutely discharged. You're absolutely discharged. I swim into my rebuttal time here, so I'm going to jump to the second issue, if the court will permit me, mm-hmm. which is that if the court disagrees with me, and I realize I've got an uphill battle, well, in that case, Mr. Wilson should have been permitted to present the evidence of the discharge to the jury, so the jury could decide whether or not, in fact, the government should be permitted to prosecute him where Wisconsin implied, at least, that he could possess ammunition.
Isn't that a legal issue, counsel? Why would we put a legal issue to the jury? Just an interpretation of the federal statute.
Judge Sykes, if, as a matter of law, this court rules that Mr. Wilson can be charged with this offense, felon in possession of ammunition, then it is a question of fact for the jury to decide as to whether or not he has a defense, whether or not the government should be stopped from prosecuting him because he was induced. It would resemble an entrapment defense. Again, I can't show you a case where this was successfully brought, but I know it's been brought up, and it seems to me to be meritorious under the facts of this case. If I may jump briefly to the sentencing issue, since I have 1 minute left, basically I think we're back down to where the question of whether or not the sentence was reasonable. We're not trying to say that the sentence was a Sixth Amendment violation. I understand the court has recently ruled in the George case. I think it would apply. So I think the question for sentencing here becomes, did the court properly find that this was that this possession of ammunition was in connection with another felony? I would submit that it was not. The evidence doesn't support that Mr. Wilson possessed the ammunition in order to assist the person who did the shooting. In this case, there would have to be some sort of indication on the record that he knew Allen, Mr. Allen, the shooter, had shot someone, or it just shows that he was in trouble, and there's nothing to show that he intended that this would help Allen escape responsibility. Thank you.
Ms. Rumbelow.
May it please the court, counsel, Rita Rumbelow for Appellee, United States of America. As this court recognized, federal law governs the interpretation of the unless clause of Title 18, United States Code, Section 921A20. And in this case, Mr. Wilson did receive a discharge certificate from the state of Wisconsin, which unequivocally told him that he may not possess firearms as a convicted felon. So the state of Wisconsin clearly treats Mr. Wilson as a convicted felon. Then we look at the interpretation of the unless clause, and in the Caron case that the appellant just referred to, the Supreme Court said that with the regards to weapons possession, the federal government has an interest in a single national protective policy that's broader than required by state law. And in that case, the state of Massachusetts allowed convicted felons to possess long guns, but not handguns. And the Supreme Court upheld a conviction under 922G when the defendant possessed a long gun, because they said as long as the state prohibited a convicted felon from possessing one type of weapon, they are a convicted felon for all purposes. As Judge Easterbrook noted, then they are convicted felons under the United States Code. So it is all or nothing, as the Supreme Court ruled in the Caron case, and Mr. Wilson falls under that. And in DeRue, which is an Eighth Circuit case cited in my brief, as well as Fisher, a Tenth Circuit case cited in my brief, defendants argued they could possess ammunition because the state allowed possession of ammunition. And again, the circuit courts held, no, absolutely not. It's all or nothing. The state prohibited you from possessing firearms. Therefore, under the United States Code, you may not possess ammunition. And as an aside, I mean, the appellant wants the state of Wisconsin to tell him, as Judge Eastbrook noted, are they supposed to list every single thing that the United States Code prohibits them from possessing? Absolutely not. And the state of Wisconsin is obviously also not going to tell a convicted felon, oh, you're right, you can possess ammunition. I mean, they don't prohibit the possession of ammunition, so there's no way they're going to try to restore that right. So clearly, in this instance, the court had jurisdiction, and Mr. Wilson was properly convicted of violating Title 18 United States Code, Section 922G. Mr. Wilson also argues that he should have been allowed to present evidence of his discharge certificate to the jury. He says he wanted to present it as a theory of defense to show that he didn't know that he couldn't possess ammunition, and that a reasonable person could have thought from the language of the discharge certificate, you know, that they didn't know they could not possess ammunition. Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion in not allowing the discharge certificate to go to the jury for two reasons. First, as an element of Title 18 United States Code Section 922G, the government had to prove that Mr. Wilson knowingly possessed ammunition. That is what the jury was instructed on, and that's what the government did prove. The government, knowledge of the law, as Judge Easterbrook noted, knowledge is just United States Code. We don't have to tell convicted felons that they're prohibited from possessing 20 different objects. The United States Code provides sufficient notice. So we didn't have to prove that Mr. Wilson knew he could not possess ammunition. So it just, that was irrelevant, and that it was proper not to allow the discharge certificate in front of the jury for that purpose, because knowledge of the law is not a defense. And as Judge Sykes noted, whether or not Mr. Wilson is a convicted felon for purposes of federal law is an issue of law that was not properly in front of the jury. The jury can't decide whether or not Mr. Wilson actually was a convicted felon for purposes of 921A20. As we just discussed, the issue's been you know, litigated endlessly in all courts and the United States Supreme Court. And so the interpretation of the unless clause is obviously an issue of law. And so, again, that was another reason why Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion in not allowing the discharge certificate to go to the jury. As for sentencing, Mr. Wilson had originally argued that his sentencing violated the Sixth Amendment, but after the government submitted its 28J letter recently, citing to the recent decision in this court from April 4th in United States versus George, seems to me Mr. Wilson now is retracting his initial argument, but is still claiming that the sentence was somehow unreasonable. However, as this court noted in the George case, a sentence below the otherwise applicable sentencing guideline range is not unreasonably high, and that is exactly what happened in this case. Had the guidelines applied, had they been mandatory and everything like that, the guideline range would have been 130 to 162 months.
That was a legally impermissible sentence, though, wasn't it? Because
yes,
it exceeded the statutory maximum. Statutory maximum.
Exactly. Right. So Judge Crabb could not sentence within the otherwise applicable guideline range, so she chose the statutory maximum sentence of 120 months. Very similar to the fact situation in George. In George, the otherwise applicable guideline range would have been 63 to 78 months. The statutory maximum was 60 months, but in that case, actually, Judge Rhonda went down to a term of 48 months, far below the otherwise applicable guideline range. And so, and this court held in George, again, that a sentence below the guideline range is not unreasonably high, therefore it cannot be unreasonable. And in this case, because Mr. Wilson's sentence was only 120 months, and the otherwise applicable guideline range would have been 130 to 160 months, it was not unreasonable. And Judge Crabb's sentence fully complied with the requirements of Booker. She did look to the statutory purposes of sentencing under Section 3553A. She chose a sentence of 120 months, which she indicated she would have chosen if the guidelines had ultimately been ruled as constitutional. She would have chosen the same exact sentence. And she chose that sentence because Mr. Wilson had two prior felony convictions for crimes of violence, yet he still possessed at least 8 boxes of 9mm ammunition. She said Mr. Wilson was a sex offender, which he continually denied. She noted that Mr. Wilson had been undeterred from criminal conduct despite early juvenile court intervention at the age of 9 and a lengthy term of prior imprisonment. She imposed the sentence because of the need to protect the community and to reflect the seriousness of Mr. Wilson's offense. And she also wanted to provide Mr. Wilson with the opportunity to engage in drug treatment and maybe therapy for his sexual predator issues. So Judge Crabb, it's almost like she had a crystal ball. I mean, she was in line with what the Supreme Court ultimately ruled in the Booker case. She looked at the guidelines as advisory. She chose a discretionary sentence. She considered the factors in 3553A, and she felt that a sentence of 120 months was appropriate in this case, and that sentence was reasonable. So for all those reasons, the United States asked this court to affirm the judgment and conviction of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Romolo. Mr. Karp, we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you have anything further.
Thank you very much. I'll try to make good use of it. I'll just refer my state, restrict my argument to the sentencing issue. The sentence was a maximum sentence for the statute. Our position is that it was not reasonable because the wrong guideline range was used. But for the four-point enhancement that the court found was appropriate in an advisory way, the advisory guideline range would have topped out at 115 months. So there is something at stake here for Mr. Wilson. And the government's theory as to why the four-point enhancement applies is that Mr. Wilson assisted another person to conceal, that is, he aided a felon. However, in order to do that, they would have had to show he wasn't a relative and that he actually helped Mr. Allen escape arrest or conviction. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. And